Shalom, a 5-minute update, and we are doing this update live for you on Ustream as well, and we hope to be able to now on a weekly basis be broadcasting the update on Ustream as well as capturing it and saving it in audio form where you can listen to it on MP3 as well. So as you know, here in our update, what we do is we're examining this past week's current events and seeing how they relate and pertain to the prophecies of the end of days. Now, the big picture is that the nations of the world are prophesied to divide the land of Israel. That's Joel chapter 3, verse 2, and the city of Jerusalem, Zechariah in chapter 14, in verse 2. That will bring about the judgment of the nations. The judgment of the nations is twofold. It is war among the nations and its economic collapse. Now, from the economic collapse, there will be a restructuring in the setting up of one world government, and that's Revelation chapter 13, and the one world government system will be set up the Passover, the beginning of the last 3.5 years. Now, we're also watching to get an affirmation of the understanding of the prophecy in Daniel chapter 9 about the 70 weeks of Daniel, wherein we're looking at the possibility, if we are understanding the prophecy correctly, of perhaps the tribulation starting this year. But whether that is the case or not, only time will tell, and depending upon the things that happen this year, we shall see. And of course, the major thing that we're going to look at and examine is the current status of the peace process and see how close we are perhaps of Israel agreeing to a Palestinian state in the borders of that Palestinian state. You see, in Daniel in chapter 9, the prophecy is all about Jerusalem, Mark, and the things that are going on in Jerusalem. And so an agreement on borders for a Palestinian state, it is an agreement on the status of Jerusalem. So let's begin our update by looking at the news articles for this past week to try to help us understand the current situation with the peace process. And what they're working to do is to start negotiations indirectly. So this first article is from a Russian website from February the 24th, and it says, indirect Palestinian-Israeli talks may restart in March. Israel and the Palestinian National Authority may resume indirect talks within the next 2 weeks, a London-based Arab newspaper said on Wednesday, citing Palestinian sources. And then from the same Russian website, the headline from February the 24th is the Mideast Quartet. Now, the Mideast Quartet consists of the United States, Europe, Russia, and the United Nations. And they are scheduling a tentative meeting in Moscow for March the 19th. The article says a meeting of the quartet of international mediators in Israeli-Palestinian peace talks will be held in Moscow on March the 19th. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said on Wednesday, we can announce that we have agreed with all the participants of the quartet to hold a ministerial meeting in Moscow on March the 19th, Lavrov said. Now, the next article is from the Jerusalem Post, February the 25th, and the headline reads, the European Union is stating that goods produced in the West Bank are not Israeli. And so this is part of the non-recognition of the West Bank as being a part of the state of Israel. And ultimately, this is setting up facts on the ground so that ultimately Israel will be in the fullness of time agreeing to a Palestinian state. And so the article goes on to say the European Union's High Court ruled Thursday that products that Israeli companies make in the West Bank are subject to import duties in the European Union because they are not covered by trade agreements the bloc has with Israel or the Palestinian Authority. Existing European Union trade agreements charge no import duties on Israeli products made in Israel and Palestinian ones made in the West Bank. So this is an important development, as well as this one. This is from World Net Daily, February the 23rd. The headline is that the U.S. government is on board for considering a Palestinian unilateral statehood through the United Nations without an agreement with Israel through negotiations. Recent meetings between the Obama administration and the Palestinian Authority revealed the White House is on board to a Palestinian threat to unilaterally ask the United Nations to recognize a Palestinian state outside of negotiations with Israel, a senior Palestinian Authority negotiator told WorldNet Daily. The negotiator further claimed the entire European Union leadership has backed the plan. WorldNet Daily previously reported that the Palestinian Authority's chief negotiator, Saeb Erekat, headed a team that held a series of meetings in December with members of the Obama administration in Washington to discuss the U.S. response should the Palestinians bring to the U.N. Security Council a resolution to unilaterally, Palestinian official told WorldNet Daily in December, referring to media claims that the U.S. would veto any such resolution. Yesterday, a senior Palestinian Authority negotiator stated the Obama administration still has not threatened to veto the conceptual unilateral resolution and even indicated that the U.S. would support such a resolution. The U.S. prefers a negotiated settlement, but indicated they would back the resolution if talks don't progress, the Palestinian negotiator said. The official also said the U.S. supports the creation of a Palestinian state in the 1967 borders, meaning the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and eastern sections of Jerusalem. So it appears to me that the United States is taking the position, telling Israel that we are willing to support a UN resolution to recognize a Palestinian state, even if there is no negotiated settlement between the Palestinians and Israel, as a threat, and I believe willing to back up that threat if need be, as a threat to try to pressure Israel into getting that negotiated settlement, which the United States would like Israel to do. Because ultimately, if there is a public appearance of a negotiated settlement, then the United States don't have to politically deal with the fact that they forced Israel to do something. So that's why they would like to put the pressure on as strongly as possible to encourage them to agree to negotiations. And so it appears that the reports are that those indirect talks will begin sometime in March. And so being watchmen on the wall, what we are looking at is if perhaps they are able to get a negotiated settlement on borders by the end of May, because we have at the end of May the Feast of Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks, and we're looking at perhaps this Feast of Shavuot or this Feast of Weeks to start the tribulation if we get the corresponding signs to indicate that it would be the case. And what we're looking at to affirm this is some type of agreement regarding Jerusalem. Now, I don't know whether that agreement actually has to take place at Shavuot. It could take place later on in the year, but we're still in the the year of counting Shavuot. So we'll see how that goes. So that concludes the updated information regarding the peace process. And now we're going to go and look at the present situation regarding Iran. From Haaretz, this is February the 22nd. The headline says, the U.S. places Iran nuclear issue on the pressure track. The United States is placing its efforts to thwart the Iranian nuclear program on a pressure track ahead of U.S. Central Command General David Petraeus and in an interview to a U.S. network on Sunday. Speaking to NBC's Meet the Press, Petraeus said that he thought that no one at the end of this time can say that the United States and the rest of the world have not given Iran every opportunity to resolve the issues diplomatically. That puts us in a solid foundation now to go on what is termed the pressure track, the U.S. general said, adding that that's the course of which we are starting on now. So they've been in the negotiations in trying to persuade Iran through diplomacy. That is further pressure tactics. Now, what are these increased pressure tactics? It is to try to separate the Iranian banking system from the rest of the world, and also squeeze Iran through energy. So it's a pressure attack on, and a greater pressure upon Iranians' financial and energy sectors. So this article is from Spiegel Online, and this is a German website. It says, the European Union is preparing tough sanctions against Iran's energy and financial sectors, according to a confidential list of proposals drawn up for EU foreign ministers and obtained by Spiegel Online. The measures aimed at forcing Iran to back down in the nuclear dispute would have a dramatic impact on their economy. The statement by the EU foreign ministers after their meeting in Brussels on Monday sounded harmless. The EU would stick to its dual-track approach of threatening economic sanctions and offering negotiations to stop Iran from developing nuclear weapons. So far, however, that strategy hasn't worked. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad announced plans on Monday to build two new uranium enrichment plants despite warnings issued by the UN Security Council, the United States, and Europe. The world powers should not be worried, as all of our nuclear activities are strictly supervised by the inspectors of the International Atomic Energy Agency, for Amin Memarpara said in a press briefing in Iran on Tuesday. But such assurances don't wash with Europeans anymore. The European Union wants to massively ratchet up the pressure on Iran, and the instruments have already been prepared. Behind the scenes, European Union finance and trade experts have worked out a confidential catalog of possible sanctions. Spiegel Online has obtained that catalog, a 13-page non-paper on political and economic context of sanctions against Iran. So the two major areas, once again, is their banking industry, to shut Iranian banks out from working with the international banking community, and then also to squeeze the energy sector of Iran as well. So they're trying to bring down the Iranian economy, and that's the pressure that they're now talking because the diplomatic approach, since Obama has taken office. They are now going to begin the process sometime in March to this pressure to the financial and energy sector of the Iranian economy. Now, the only question should be is how long are they going to give for the pressure track to work, and how long are they going to give to decide whether it is working or not? Because obviously, when the pressure track is over and it doesn't work, then the next thing to do is to actually go to war, go to physical war. Actually, shutting out the banks in the energy sector is a start of war. It's economic war. So you might say that the war has started, but it's economic at the moment. It is not yet military. But if this economic war does not work, then they will do the military war. And so, like I said, the issue is going to become how long are they going to give the pressure track to work? 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, a year, 18 months? We don't know, but that is the ultimate question. Now, since the United States and the European Union are looking to pressure Iran through its finance and energy sectors, now I'm going to share with you the Russian and Chinese response. So, from Press TV, February the 20th, the headline is, Russia rebuffs Israel over tougher sanctions on Iran. Russia's foreign ministry has announced that Moscow is against imposing crippling sanctions on Iran over its nuclear energy program. The term crippling sanctions on Iran is totally unacceptable to us. The sanctions should aim at strengthening the regime of non-proliferation, Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryakov said on Friday. He made the comments in opposition to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who asked Russia to help slap biting sanctions on the Israeli Republic. So from Haaretz, February the 24th, the headline reads, Russia will not support crippling Iran sanctions. Russia will not support crippling sanctions against Iran, including any that may be slapped on the Israeli Republic's banking or energy sectors, a senior Russian diplomat said on Wednesday. We are not going to work on sanctions or measures which would lead to the political or economic or financial isolation of this country, Oleg Roskoff, Deputy Director of the Security Affairs and Disarmament Department at Russia's foreign minister told reporters. Proliferation is there in forbidding banking activities with Iran. This is a financial blockade. In oil and gas, these sanctions are aimed only at paralyzing the country and paralyzing the Iranian government. Now from the Times Online, February the 17th, the headline is, Only China has the power to cripple Iran and the West knows it. Hillary Clinton used her first appearance as U.S. Secretary of State before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee to warn once again of crippling sanctions against Iran. Ever since she first uttered the phrase in April last year, crippling sanctions has been the benchmark for threats of international action. Action against a defiant Iran to prove unworkable and could even start a war, the very outcome they are designed to avoid. Crippling has become a code word for a blanket ban on Iran's import of refined petroleum products, particularly gas. The Islamic Republic has the world's second largest proven oil reserves. They have about 11% of the world's total oil reserves. Its lack of oil refineries, however, means that it has to import about 40% of its refined products. Iran has made contingency plans for dealing with future additional international sanctions by identifying potential alternate suppliers of gasoline, including China and Venezuela. To stop a Venezuelan tanker carrying gas to the Iranian port, for instance, Western nations would have to resort to their naval power in the Gulf. Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, has pointed out that such a blockade would amount to an act of war. The Iranian response could trigger a real shooting war. So what is behind the Western drive for crippling sanctions? Of course, the first goal is to avert the potentially devastating war that could follow a preemptive strike on Iran's nuclear sites, either by Israel or the United States. But the Western strategy is also an acknowledgement that China is the only country which might have the power to force Iran to change track. So the United States is indicating regarding Iran, Europe as well, that they need to go to the next phase of pressure because things currently aren't working, to isolate the Iranian financial and energy sectors. House says we will not support that. So the significance is that if the United States is serious about this, and if the pressure work, that means they will have to attack Iran, perhaps with Israel as well, without the support of Russia and China, which really means an attack on Iran will, in the end, start World War III. And so, now, in the book of Joel, in chapter 3, as a result of indicating to us two things, the nations dividing the land of Israel and kicking Jews out of their homes. In Joel chapter 3, verse 2, it says, I will gather all nations and bring them to the valley of Jehoshaphat, and I will plead with them there for my people and for my heritage Israel, whom they scattered among the nations and parted or divided my land. Then it goes on to say in verse 6, the children of Judah and the children of Jerusalem have sold themselves to the Grecians that they might remove them far from their border. So we're being told here in Joel chapter 3 that the nations are going to divide the land of Israel and kick Judah and Jerusalem out of their homes. And as a result of this, it goes on to say in Joel chapter 3 verse 9, proclaim this among the nations, prepare for war. So when we have the dividing of the land and Jews being kicked out of their homes in the West Bank and in Jerusalem, the prophecies say, tell the nations to prepare for war. Well, what is happening here in the news? The nations are preparing for war. The United States is preparing. They're going down a road that will ultimately, if present things don't work out, they will have to attack Iran. Now, not only did Russia warn that they are not going to support this, but the Russian general Nikolai Makarov said that if the United States attack Iran, which he says they're able to do, that it will result in the collapse of the U.S. economy. So this article is from the NowPublic.com, and it says, Russian General Nikolai Makarov have been recently interviewed on Russian TV, and he discussed his thoughts regarding the United States and Iran. He doesn't feel like the possibility of waging a war against Iran is a global consequence. Russia's General of the Army, Nikolai Makarov, chief of the General Staff of the Armed Forces of the Russian Federation, warned that in a moment when the U.S. is bogged down in two wars might lead to the collapse of the United States. He said that such an attack could roil the region and have negative consequences for Russia, who is a neighbor of Iran via the Caspian Sea, and said the Russian military has taken steps to forestall any U.S. strike on Iran. Makarov made the remarks on Vezliad on Friday, February the 19th, and they were translated or paraphrased by the USG Open Source Center. Makarov also commented on the recent rumors about the possibility of an attack upon Iran by the United States. In his opinion, this would be a complete madness on part of the American military. He said Admiral Michael McMullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, recently said that in the United States, there is a plan. The United States clearly understands that now, when it is conducting two military campaigns, one in Iraq and the other in Afghanistan, and a third campaign against Iran, would lead simply to a collapse. It would not be able to withstand the strain on the U.S. military. Nevertheless, in proportion to the winding down of the campaigns in Iraq and Afghanistan, the plan for a war with the Islamic Republic of Iran, in the opinion of General Makarov, may again come out to the foreground. General, following this situation, So the fact that an American war with Iran is going to lead, set up dominoes that will lead to the economic collapse of the United States is what the Bible prophesies. In Isaiah in chapter 13, it talks about the burden of Babylon, and the setting is the day of the Lord. And it says in Isaiah 13, verse 17, that the Medes will rise up against Babylon, be at war with Babylon. A war with Iran would bring about economic collapse in the United States, agreeing with what the Russian general said. What I expect is that the military attack against Iran, when it happens, will be successful. It will be devastating. It will be successful. Now, where the United States is going to have problems is the consequence, the fallout from such an attack on the world economy, and also upsetting the Islamic world. And so that's where I believe the challenges are, not on the military strike itself, but on the fallout of the military attack. So the last thing I'm going to cover then on the update is the status of the U.S. challenge facing the housing industry as it tries to recover from the worst slump in decades. The Commerce Department reported Wednesday that new home sales dropped 11% last month to a seasonally adjusted annual sales pace of 309,000, the lowest level on record going back nearly 50 years. The big drop was a surprise to economists who had expected sales would rise about 5% over December's pace. So, home sales, which is a big part of the U.S. economy now since our manufacturing base is lost, that our economic expansion from 9/11 was driven by housing. Now, with new home sales at a 50-year low, the economy is not going to be able to recover and be sustained. Once again, from Yahoo Finance, February the 23rd, regulators report a 27% jump in problem U.S. banks. The number of problem U.S. banks jumped 27% during the fourth quarter of 2009 to 702 on the problem list, the highest level since 1993, and a sign that the industry's recovery is still shaky, regulators reported on Tuesday. And now this is an incredible information from CNN Money, February the 24th. It says nearly 25% of all mortgages in the United States, people owe more on their houses than what their houses are worth. 25%. More bad news on the housing bust front. Nearly 25% of all mortgage borrowers were underwater, meaning they owe more on their loans than their homes are worth. Nevada was the state with the worst record, as 70% of all mortgages are underwater. This was followed by Arizona, 51%, Florida, 48%, Michigan, 39%, and California, 35%. Now, with that number of people who owe more on their houses than what they are worth, and with official unemployment at 10%, but unofficial unemployment closer to 16 to 20%, when you count those who have quit looking for work, discouraged, and those who doing part-time work that would like full-time work, that with such a fragile economy, it's not going to bid well for housing in the United States, that we're going to have further housing problems. And as we have further housing problems, it's going to perhaps bring down the U.S. economy. Now, Another troubling sign for the United States economy is states are reporting that once again that their tax collections are down. And this is from Yahoo Finance, February the 23rd. States again saw a sharp decline in tax collections in the last quarter of 2009, a record fifth straight quarterly drop, according to a new report that predicts more looming spending cuts or tax increases. Overall revenue from state tax collections dropped 4% for the quarter compared to the same quarter in 2008. Now remember, 2008 was when we was in the initial drop in the economy. And so that was down from 2007. And so when the states can't meet their budget obligations, what they've done in the past is they've always raised taxes. They've always raised sales tax. They've raised income tax. Well, we're getting to the point now where raising taxes is going to be counterproductive, uproar from the American people. Their only other alternative then is to cut expenses. And you know, state government and federal government do not run themselves like a business. They do not try to operate efficiency. And when they put someone on the payroll, they don't easily take them off. And the states are being challenged, and I'm sure they're going to be challenged when 2010 tax receipts come in, especially for this coming April. So as a result of these things, in the month of February, the American consumer is starting to lose hope. They still had hope in January that things was going to turn around because that's what they were being told in the media. That's what the Obama administration was telling them. But they started to seriously doubt it in February. And from CNNMoney.com, it says consumer confidence plummets, and the index that gauges consumer confidence fell to an all-time low in February. A key measure of consumer sentiment fell more than expected in February to the lowest level since its 1967 inception, as Americans remain weary of spending in the weak economy and rising unemployment. The Conference Board, a New York-based business research group, said its consumer confidence index fell to 25 in February from a revised reading of 37 in January. The index has been touching historical lows since September. Economists were expecting a reading of 35. Now look, economists were expecting a 35 rather than a 37. It came in at 25. Economists was expecting a rise in home sales, and it dropped. So economists are buying into the media saying all the recovery's here, and the Obama administration saying a recovery's here. Meanwhile, the American people are not buying into it. So two-thirds of the American economy is dependent upon the American people spending their money. And when they have 25% of homes in the United States, the people owe more than what the homes are worth. When there's high unemployment and when their confidence is at a more than a 30-year low, even a 40-year low, over a 40-year low, then the economy is not going to improve without the American consumer. Now, this next article is from the Washington Times, February the 25th, and you're aware that there was a strong push by the U.S. Congress in the Federal Reserve to pass stimulus package emergency measures to save the economy, and as a part of these measures, the Obama administration last year ran a $1.5 trillion budget deficit, and they're projected to have a $1.5 trillion budget deficit for this coming year as well. So the policies contributed to record budget deficit, and the Obama administration, the Federal Reserve, advocated that these policies need to be done. Now, once we got the record budget deficit, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, is now saying, hey, there's a problem that the United States has too much debt. With uncharacteristic bluntness, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke warned Congress on Wednesday that the United States could soon face a debt crisis like the one in Greece. Now, let me remind you how the globalists, what their policies are. Many things that happen in our world are planned at high levels in the U.S. government and internationally by globalist leaders, globalist think tanks. And oftentimes, if they're planning or projecting something, a major cake to the American people, problems in the area, so that when the thing happens, they won't be so totally shocked. So when the Federal Reserve Chairman is warning the possibility that there could be a debt crisis in the United States like one in Greece, I believe he is, this is my opinion, he's preparing the American public for one. And he then declared that the central bank will not help legislators by printing money to pay for the ballooning federal debt, which, by the way, in the past year, they have been printing money at a hugely significant pace to keep the economy afloat. Recent events in Europe, where Greece and other nations with large unsustainable deficits like the United States are having increased trouble selling their debts to investors, show that the United States is vulnerable to a sudden reversal of fortunes that would force taxpayers to pay higher interest rates on the debt. It's not something that's 10 years away. It affects the market currently, he told the House Financial Services Committee. Why and how is that so? Because a significant part of the U.S. debt is short-term debt. So when it rolls over, if no one's going to be buying the debt, they have to pay more interest to get someone to buy the debt. And of course, that drives up the debt itself, because so much of the debt is interest. Bernanke goes on to say, it's possible that bond markets will become worried about the sustainability of yearly deficits of over $1 trillion, and we may find ourselves facing higher interest rates even today. He didn't say maybe a year or two. He said even today or even in the near future. And so he's pointing or indicating or putting out the thought to the bond markets of, hey, you know, you may, it's okay for you to be concerned about the budget debt and therefore be hesitant about buying the debt. That's the message he's being put out. And then as a result, he's putting out the message of the possibility of the U.S. Not being able to finance its debt. So what that would mean in practical terms is a collapse of the U.S. dollar. And with that in mind, I would like to play for you a minute and a half spot from YouTube. And this is an interview that Alex Jones did with Pastor Lindsey Williams on Wednesday. Now, for those of you who may not be familiar with Pastor Lindsey Williams, his testimony, his background is that I believe it was in the 1970s. He worked as a chaplain on the Alaskan oil pipeline, and he was asked to participate and be a part of meetings of the global elite. And he saw that what was discussed in those meetings actually came to pass in the real world, that they were policy makers, policy setters about where things was going to be going in the U.S. and the world economy. In I believe it was the summer of 08 now. Lindsey had a conversation with one of the people that he was interacting with back in the 70s, hadn't talked with him for 20 or 25 years. And in this conversation, specified to Lindsey that oil was going from $150 a barrel to $50 a barrel, which it did. It actually went down to $35 a barrel. And Lindsey asking, what can we expect to see happen in the next 12 months? And he indicated to him that there was a strong likelihood that in 2009 that the U.S. economy was going to collapse. But then when he talked with him in November of 2009, he said that they modified their plans because of the passage of the stimulus money and other emergency measures, which the U.S. government and the Federal Reserve wanted to be done. As a result of that, they altered their timeline and they postponed the collapse of the U.S. Economy. And so now Lindsay had a follow-up conversation with this global elite person, and I'd like to share with you, this is a minute and a half, so it's got to go quickly, what Lindsay is reporting, what he was told on Wednesday, what to expect for the rest of 2010, covering events for the next 12 months. So we're going to be playing that for you right now.
But Lindsay, recap your saga with this individual, and then let's get into the predictions. I mean, what this fellow said the elite are going to do now. Lindsay Williams.
I mean, the privilege of being on your show today, because yesterday, Wednesday, the 24th, this month of February, I was on the phone with the elitist who over the years has given me so much information. And in the course of our conversation, I was so startled by what he told me that the elitists have in store for every American this year, 2010. I immediately called up Jaron, your producer, and I said, please, Alex, audience needs to know this. It's so important. And Alex,
so this is the first time.
The very next day, you'd let me be on your show.
So this is the first time this info is being revealed.
Yes, this is the first show that I have given his conversation on yesterday, just yesterday. With I've been on nobody else's show since then, and this gentleman
told me
something so startling. I said I've got to tell people as fast as I can.
Okay, let's break it down, and then we'll go back through each point in detail.
Okay, first of all, let me tell you, I'll give them to you, and, yeah, as you said, and break them down. First of all, he said, how much the dollar is going to change in value in the next 12 months, 2010. He said that 30 to 50%, and he elaborated it, went on. Second thing.
Okay, there it is. The major thing that he told him was that in the next 12 months, there's going to be a 30 to 50% devaluation of the U.S. dollar. And that only comes about through a collapse of the U.S. dollar. And so he's indicated that this is on the agenda. This is on the plans of the global elite. And if that is so, that may be the reason why Ben Bernanke is issuing this warning about there's a risk out there, so that when it happens, he can say, hey, I told you so. And then if we then have a collapse of the U.S. dollar, we need to have a replacement on the international arena regarding international trade. In other words, we need a replacement reserve currency. And so here we have the head of the International Monetary Fund, this is an article from ABC News, specifying that the IMF is recommending that there be an international world currency to replace the U.S. dollar. So they're beginning to prepare the public for the collapse of the dollar and what needs to be done as a result of it. So the article says, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, the head of the International Monetary Fund, suggested Friday the organization might one day be called on to provide countries with a global reserve currency that would serve as an alternative to the U.S. dollar. The day has not yet come, but I think it is intellectually healthy to explore these kinds of ideas now, he said in a speech on the future mandate of the 186-nation Washington-based lending organization. Strauss-Kahn said such an asset could be similar to, but distinctly different from, the International Monetary Fund's special drawing rights, or SDRs, the accounting unit that countries use to hold funds within the IMF. It is based on a basket of major currencies. He said having other alternatives to the dollar would limit the extent to which the international monetary system as a whole depends on the policies and conditions of a single, howbeit dominant, country. And so I believe with all my heart that it's going to be the collapse of the U.S. economy and the collapse of the U.S. dollar in particular that will create the conditions for Revelation 13 to be fulfilled. The setting up of one world government, one world currency, and control over the population of the world that no man may buy or sell unless they agree to participate and be a part of that new system that gets set up. And I believe perhaps that this is why there is such an effort by the Obama administration and the Democratic Party to push through health care, because one of the mandates of the health care, that most of the provisions of the health care proposal is going to go into effect 2013-2014. And one of those things, I believe it's in the congressional part of the health care bill, that it mandates that everyone have their health information be on a chip that is implantable, so you don't lose your health information because you're going to be required to have it in U.S. citizens. So that could end up turning out to be some element or aspect of no one may buy or sell. So if we have the tribulation starting sometime in 2010, a tribulation event is the collapse of the world economic system, the fall of the financial Babylon system. And if they restructure to bring in world government, one world currency, and if they get health care passed and it has this mandate on it, that in the restructuring, then they're going to have absolute dictatorial powers over your life, because health care governs your life from birth to death. So I believe we're looking at very strong signs in our present news of the fulfillment of tribulation events. So based upon that, I believe that we are most likely very close to starting the tribulation and seeing the fulfillment, major events of the tribulation period. So what we need to keep watching is how things go regarding the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, to see whether the pressure that the United States and Europe is putting upon Israel to agree to a Palestinian state in the borders of that Palestinian state, threatening that if they don't, that there'll be recognition of a Palestinian state anyhow by the United Nations. We'll continue to watch the development to see where this goes, as well as watching the developments regarding Iran, because a United States war with Iran is a tribulation event. The collapse of the U.S. and world economy is a tribulation event. And these things are at the forefront of our present day news. So that's how close we are possibly to entering into tribulation days. Now, this is not, and nor is it meant to be, all gloom and doom, because this is what the Bible prophesies what will happen, and from the God of Israel's perspective, it ends up with great rejoicing. And that is, as a result of these things happening, it's going to trigger the end of the exile of the house of Jacob, the reunification of Ephraim and Judah, Ezekiel chapter 37, verses 15 through 28. And it's prophesied that the nations of the world will not allow the exiles of Israel to return to the land of Israel, and will not allow the desire for Ephraim and Judah to become one. And the prophecies say that as a result, judgment will come upon the nations for refusing to let the exiles of Israel go, just like judgment came upon Pharaoh. And the purpose of these judgments and the miracle way in which the God of Israel is going to deliver his people, these miracles exceed the miracles of the historical Egyptian exodus. And as a result, we will see in this process the revealing of the Messiah of Israel and the Messiah of Israel and the exiles of Israel being glorified. And this will culminate in the Messiah setting his feet down on the Mount of Olives and then him setting up his kingdom where the Torah is going to go forth from Jerusalem. And his redeemed bride will be kings and priests ruling and reigning with him. So the Bible compares these events to a woman's pregnancy and the birth of a baby. That hard upon a woman, but the birth of the baby brings forth great joy. And so the tribulation is a time of great pain, great heartache, but the birth that comes from the tribulation is the end of the exile, the revealing of the Messiah in the Messianic era. And that's what we need to keep our eyes focused on and maintain our hope, our faith, and our confidence, because the kingdom is about to be established, the Messiah is about to be revealed, and Yeshua is about to be glorified. So I pray that this update has been helpful, insight, a blessing to you. Would like to remind you now that you can review and listen to the audio of the update and see links to the articles that I just shared with you on our website for that purpose. Watchmen, that is W-A-T-C-H-M-A-N, watchmenofzion.com. And we will have links not only to the audio of the 5-minute update, but we'll have a link to the Ustream video of it as well. So for those of you who enjoy the video streaming, the video of the 5-minute update is archived, and you'll be able to watch it on demand here from the site throughout the week, should you choose to do so again or want to notify your friends that they are able to view the update through the video. So keep looking up and keep watching, because our redemption draws nigh. Shalom in Yeshua the Messiah. Amen.